you've tapped or clicked in to College Volleyball Weekly on Viral Volley Media. Now here's your host, Rob on mic.
Hey, good day, everyone. You're not watching the net live, but I did see the founder of the show, week 19 of College Volleyball Weekly, men's top 20, a lot of championships, a lot of matches this last week. We figured we'd just jump right into the ditty. But before that, we got to meet Brad Rothschild of UC San Diego, Jay Hossack of the newly branded George Mason University. I thought it'd be the mighty Hossacks, but that's okay. Then we got Theo Edwards of CSUN and Dan Friend of Lewis. 19 weeks of excellent volleyball culminated into this last week of play, and wanted to get your guys' thoughts and everything we saw, starting with, well, we kind of talked about the All-American team already, but we can start there and then go into Tuesday's quarterfinals. Wanted to get your thoughts on matches we saw on quarterfinal day and thoughts of the overall scene and any standout performers. Just kind of throw it out there. Now we'll start with, Dan's got a great thinking position right now, so I'm going to hit him up first.
I'm just pausing on you as I'm still thinking. Do you know what I mean? So Tuesday's matches, I think we knew with Fort Valley and Belmont Abbey, and certainly there were moments in both those matches where guys had some highlights and did some nice things for those programs, and kudos to both those programs for getting there. But those two matches, we knew who was going to win. I was honestly a little disappointed in the other two. I think I was hoping, you know, Ohio State showed up a little bit, but not at the level that I was hoping, or Pasture didn't find that next level walking into that. The other match with Penn State, kind of the same thing. It was kind of like underwhelming on those two matches. There was certainly competitive volleyball, and the matches were back and forth. But I thought we'd get a game or two taken off both those teams and kind of push the limit a little bit. And we didn't. I think Grand Canyon took care of business. Irvine took care of business and put themselves set up well in those semifinals matches, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But all the seeds stayed true, and you're kind of hoping for one of those upsets or one of those matches to kind of go five. But kudos to the four teams that made it into the semis, because ultimately we were set up for some great volleyball in the semis.
Yeah, good call. We'll go over to Theo.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dan hit a lot of that on the head. But, you know, essentially we were looking at the MPSF and the Big West and the battle of the top teams in those two conferences. And, I think I agree with Dan. Like, I don't know that I expected it to be that way, especially with the Ohio State and Penn State matches. I think that I at least saw a couple of set, you know, switches and a lot of tie changes, and maybe Penn State takes a set or two off of Irvine, or Ohio State takes a set or two. And for those to turn into sweeps in that quarterfinal event, I was pretty surprised, to be honest with you. But I tip my hat. I think Irvine, both Irvine and Grand Canyon, played incredibly well. And obviously them going into the semis, they were playing some really great volleyball there too. And we got to see 2-5 setters in that semifinal, and it was really exciting. I mean, I thought
talk more detail of. We're on quarterfinals right now.
Sure, we'll get deeper into that. But also I want to give a shout out. You know, Fort Valley State and Belmont Abbey. You know, both of those teams had great seasons and got themselves to the tournament. And obviously those teams were swept as well. But I don't want it to go unnoticed that they had some really great players on those teams and had a great season.
Yeah, good call. Jay, they'll fish out with Brad.
I agree 100% with Dan and Theo. I think there's only to piggyback maybe in a different direction. There were two things I thought that stood out to me. One was, thank God some of those other matches didn't go five, because otherwise I'd be up till 3 o'clock in the morning. So, at least I got to bed at a decent hour that night. I think also, if you look at Fort Valley and Belmont Abbey, the way they approached the matches is just like everybody else, but they also enjoyed the moment and the experience. I think when you saw Belmont Abbey's bench, they were animated, they were having fun, they were entertaining to watch. They got it. They understood. They knew they were not a favorite team. They knew they were probably not going to win the match and most definitely weren't going to win a national title, but they squeezed every bit of juice they could out of that piece of fruit. And that was really, I think for me, that's going to help those programs recover from this pretty quickly. They're going to be able to build recruiting wise and be able to say, hey, we've done it once, we could do it again. But those kids really understood the moment and got a lot out of it. And I give kudos to them for, you know, I'm sure they were sad when it was over, but they really had a great experience. And I think that for the most part is what we should be celebrating.
Yeah. Brad.
Yeah. Belmont Abbey is they kind of went the way we expected, but that's a group and I'm pretty sure they bring back everyone or just about everyone. So that's a team I think we're going to see again in the NCAA tournament next season. And I just think that's a program that's been doing a lot of things really, really well, and will keep doing things really, really well. And then Fort Valley State, similar, where they're bringing back a lot of their key pieces. Not everyone on their starting lineup, but that's a team that's set to win the SIAC again next year. And then the other two quarterfinal matches went kind of how I foresaw them. And it's funny, we've talked about it with Penn State. We've talked about all year long, what was their setting going to look like and how are they going to handle that? And that ended up being the Achilles heel that really hurt them. And they weren't able to get John Kerr going or their middles going really at the rate. You know, I think Jay alluded to it last week that with Schwob and Toby, they weren't able to connect too well. And I thought that continued. And then the other piece of it was with the Ohio State Grand Canyon match. Ohio State's second outside hitter. That was a big piece that we were constantly watching throughout the year, and they rotated three or four different guys in that spot. And I think just having to rely so heavily on Pasture and the Wetzel overhead really made things tough over time. And then Grand Canyon just really controlled the game with their in-system offense, and Nick Slight continuing to be impressive. And I thought he was the most impressive on that day one of the tournament.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. Well, I'm going to go backwards with that Grand Canyon Ohio State match. Nick Slight definitely had the highlight of the tournament with that one-handed back dish to Rico Wardlow, who hammered it and bounced it in the pyramid on a broken play. Phenomenal play. And then
Matt August almost tackled him, and Matt August right. Like yeah. A bully there afterward.
And then for the Fort Valley State matchup, I wanted to draw some attention to some players who really stuck out. Jackson Hicks, who was the SIAC Player of the Year, had a great night that night. And I was looking forward to seeing, we kept talking about Isaiah Fed all through the season. Like, wow, why didn't he show up on our radar more often? But he's a great player. And their Libro, I'm trying to get his name, also played a great match. I mean, they were given everything they got against UCLA, and their extended rallies were proof of that. You know, did they win out? No, but you could see that Larry Rather was doing a great job really developing this team from day one of the season, because, you know, if we saw the development, and it's exponential from day one of this 2024 season to that match, the quarterfinal match. And then Belmont Abbey, pretty good team. They had three guys that really stuck out as far as play, being this court side there. And one player that we'd mentioned is an honorable mention, Matt Staskunas. But it's pretty apparent in the game plan, it was shut Staskunas down, and they did. But that meant Zach Puentes stepped up. So he was really taking the lead for Belmont Abbey. But their middle, I'm going to butcher his name. Jibril El Haddad. Watch his name next year. I don't know if he's coming back. I don't know what year it was, but his play really stuck out as I don't want to say an undersized middle. He's right around 6'6", but, you know, he's holding his own in that match in the quarterfinals. So definitely a good show by those teams representing those conferences. So any other things stick out in those quarterfinal matches on Tuesday? I think we're good. We're going to go chronologically to Wednesday, the All-American Social, which is held at the Long Beach Airport Marriott. Only the semifinal teams are there, and I got to meet two guys that I think Dan is pretty familiar with, Parker Van Buren and Daniel Fabakovic. They were sitting at my table, even though I wasn't really sitting. But, you know, great atmosphere. It was a beautiful evening. And Larry Hanno, player of the year. Surprised or not? Let's go with you guys. Let's go to, we'll start with Jay first. Oh,
I'll be honest. You know, we all talked about Hilaire as being the guy. Rumor has it during the phone call, when all the All-Americans and all that were selected, and then they went to player of the year, everybody had laid out two or three guys, that they thought would get the nod, and overwhelmingly everybody, apparently one coach spoke up that everybody knows and respects and said, why are we even having a discussion? We know who it is. Let's make it happen. And it happened pretty quick. But I'll tell you, I think Ethan Champlin could have been in that conversation for sure, especially after his performance in the finals. The kid's legit good, and he's got a real promising career when he's done playing at UCLA, making money overseas. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him on the national team very soon. And he is absolutely ridiculous, the things he can do. His footwork is so good. His arm is next level. And he just has good vision. He plays at a high level consistently. Kid can do it all. If he's around next year and Hilaire's around next year, I wouldn't be surprised to see Champlin get that nod.
Yeah. All right, Brad.
Yeah, Hanno. If it wasn't Hanno, we would have had to have a serious debate here about what's wrong with the process. So he's well deserving. Yeah, it was pretty clear.
All right, Theo.
Yeah, I mean, Hilaire had the type of season that will go down in the history books, I think. Just in terms of, we did this show every single week, and there really wasn't a week where we didn't mention him. He was just absolutely stellar, top to bottom, and I think it made it pretty simple. And you know, I echo some of the things that Jay was talking about to see the way that Ethan Champlin finished the year. And then some of the things come to light on some of the challenges that that team faced. It's interesting because I think that obviously Ethan didn't have that type of a year consistently because he was going through his own trials and tribulations. But Hilaire Hanno, man, that was one hell of a season to witness and one difficult one to coach against, I'll tell you what.
Yeah. And close out with Dan.
Yeah, I mean – Hanno for sure. Like, the guy's a stud. Like, I'll be shocked if he comes back, but he might. Like, I mean, the guy can go make money, pretty darn good money right away, right now. And so the Ethan Champlin thing, though, so, like, I think that's a tough one. Like, I think he's one of the best players in the NCAA by far. And I think I said this way beginning in a podcast, like, really impressed with him. But just the byproduct of how talented that team is, like, if he's just playing outside the whole entire year and never gets moved to libero because they're trying to figure out their lineup or any of that stuff, he might be player of the year. But because of the byproduct of, like, they've got so much talent, they're trying to shift some pieces and trying to do a couple things. He's not there, but you just see him consistently continue to win that out and has to be out on the floor because he just does so many things so well. And so, but I think he'd trade a national championship any day for saying, hey, I might be player of the year. So, I think he's okay with that from that standpoint. But, yeah, kudos to Hanno and all those guys. I thought, Rob, you could tell me I wasn't there, but looks like they actually had, like, a little bit of an actual banquet. It looked kind of like guys were dressed up and it was a table. Or what was it, more of a social? Or, like, well, it looks like it wasn't at a bowling alley or like
well, yes.
So was it like the past or was it – kind of still across the board, kind of more of just like some snack items, or what was it?
Well, it was a full buffet, and it was very similar to UCLA 2022. You know, at the hotel that their convention center is on a really nice patio, sun covered. They had a video display and a full buffet dinner. Nice. They had 360 cams going. If you want to see what I did, it's pretty funny. But backdrops and all that stuff going on. The only thing is it's in the runway of the Long Beach Airport, the takeoff route. So I had to deal with some jet turbines blowing and hold up on when I was speaking. So the jet turbines could, you know, either the jets could take off or just have a moment of silence there. So, but you know, it was a beautiful evening. It was like your typical Southern California day. Sun was beginning to set. I mean, it was so nice. And
I just had this image in my head of all you guys sitting in this airport hangar, and you got planes coming in and out and people getting on and off of planes behind you. But all of a sudden, you know, the plane's gone, but then a guy with a lawnmower in the background mowing the lawn. What are we doing? Come on, men's volleyball. Can't we have something somewhere where it's just no other issues you got to fight with? Just come on.
Well, they supplemented that with the entire flight crew of Air Malaysia, because we got to see all the flight attendants pull into their bus. Like, oh, that's not good with a bunch of guys in this hotel.
Oh, God.
I gotta add one thing, Rob, real quick. Something I forgot to mention. So Ethan Champlin, we were talking about him, and a San Diego newspaper, the San Diego Tribune, actually, and the author was Tim Meehan. He reached out to me because he was listening to the podcast, and I don't remember which episode I mentioned this in, but there was a time when I was in the gym. I think it was the Santa Barbara tournament last year, the start of 2023, where Ethan Champlin comes in the door, and so does the entire UCLA group. And he's obviously at that point in time, they end up being a national championship team, but he's their best player or one of their best players. And he's toting two bags and has another bag over his chest, like the training kit and all this other equipment. And then one of his teammates, who's also toting a bag, stops and sees his family and starts having a conversation with his family, super excited to see them. You could tell it's like a out-of-state type of experience or something like that. And Ethan figures out a way to grab that bag too and puts that thing on and then is carrying like four or five bags, right? And he, in this article, he details just like kind of what it takes to be great. And the selflessness of that young man, his willingness to be the guy who was going to give for his team. And I think Dan kind of, you know, talked about this a little bit, but his want to win, his desire to be a champion for his team was definitely trumping any individual accolades or anything that he wanted to accomplish in himself. And got to give a lot of credit to that guy, man. He earned the awards that he has been given. That's for darn sure.
Well, and that's not shocking. If you know any of the folklore of UCLA history, there's apparently a player back in the day that we may all remember named Karch Karai, who apparently the rumor is when he was not on the court during practice or the court was broken up and they were shagging and going and getting water or whatever, he would actually try to carry as many balls as he could while walking to the cart. And rather than go get water first, you know, he'd be the guy there trying to shag all this stuff. And that story gets passed down generation to generation. And there's other stories of him who would play pepper with the freshmen, and the freshmen would peter out so fast that he would have them just keep reloading with another freshman, and Karch would just keep peppering and playing. And he was hitting the ball full speed like that. And he was telling the guys he was playing with, like, hit it at me full speed. But those are the folkloric stories that we all heard about growing up. And now you're seeing somebody who may or may not have heard of those stories. I'm assuming he has, but now he's taking that next step in it and showing that, you know, his leadership skills. And it doesn't surprise me. The kid's a good kid.
Yeah. Well, so the night ended, we got the player of the year, but the assistant coach of the year, Nick McRae, and everyone knew Matt Worley, the ABCA coach of the year. So, and then the Elite 90 Award, which is the academic award, goes to Grand Canyon's Jordan Lucas. So a great night ended. Everyone wanted to get out of there, though, to prepare for the semifinal, which is hilarious. Sproul looks at me and goes, oh, excuse? Like, I'm like, they still have to take a photo, Sproul. Like, so let's jump into the semis, which actually I need to add that the quarterfinals, you know, it was said on the broadcast, it's the first ever straight set sweep day. I'm like, well, it's the first ever we've had a traditional quarterfinal, so it's obviously a first ever. So, but I mean, it was a quick night, 4 matches, 3 set sweeps, but we got the reverse story on Thursday, 2 throwdowns I mean, what could have been an epic proportions.
Rob, to start this off, I thought it was really cool. I was looking around, and last weekend, Division III National Championship, semifinals, both of them went five. This weekend, NAIA semifinals, both of them went five. And then Division I men's volleyball finals, both of them went five. So all semifinals in men's volleyball went five this year, which I don't know if that's ever happened before, but I thought that was pretty rad.
Quite a fun fact there.
And a couple reverse sweeps. Stevens, Cal Lutheran. Yeah.
Well, match number one, or semifinal number one, featured some very familiar opponents with a lot of familiar faces on both sides. The number four seed UC Irvine facing off against the number one seed UCLA. I feel like I want to go with Theo first. I've kind of ignored him a little bit here. So,
yeah, Irvine, UCLA, that's the one we're talking about first.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, the level of volleyball in these semis was so incredible. And I'm going to read off a couple of numbers here, and I want you to tell me how this is the five-set match, okay? UCLA in set one hits 391. In set two hits 455. In set three hits 538. And then in set five hits 444. Jeez. Any coach at any level, if your team is playing like that, you're like, we're winning. We got this. It's in the bag. This is simple.
Yeah. Wait a second. I need to add, though, I need to insert a little bit in the storyline for context. So in warmups, Grant Sloan goes down, lands on a ball or hurts his ankle or knee or something. And you know, I could see him on the sideline. I actually walked by him. It's like, what's going on? You know, it was pretty apparent that he's dealing with some pain and, you know, basically is a last minute scratch. Set one, which is for UC Irvine, Akil Tangatour goes down with a leg injury, and it's pretty serious. So we don't know the extent of it yet, but at that point he'd been hitting 500 and was solid in serve receive for Irvine. And they were up in that first set and had to put in their Canadian backup, who did a great job, not to take anything away from Andon Kiryoku, but he had some shoes to fill because Akil had been playing so well. So go ahead and go from there. Both teams down some pretty significant personnel.
I think that's the other nice part to this, right? Like both of these teams have dealt with various lineup changes, guys playing multiple positions. I think in the beginning of the year, we were talking about Grigorev, Max playing right side, right? And then he goes to the middle, and now we got Darcy on the right. We've had different versions of Flexen being on the right, being on the left. I think even he was in the middle at some
point. He's in the middle against Jay's team.
Right? And then
we won, by the way. Just saying.
Then obviously Tangator, right? And Tangator playing various roles as a serving sub, playing as a passer, being kind of like a, you know, more of the passing outside for them. And but anyways, I thought this was a tale of two Titans, right? I thought both of these teams played incredibly well and obviously had opportunities to win. At the end of the day, I thought UCLA was really, really great, especially in that fifth set, and was able to come away with it. But you know, you look at the numbers for UCLA, Ethan Champlin was a star. He hit 469 on 32 swings, killed 19 of them. I mean, really, really impressive. Ido David, 273. Guy Ganesh, 600. Merrick McKendry, 571. Cooper Robinson, 300. Andrew Rowan, also 500 on the attacking side. But yeah, I thought both of these teams were really, really great. And you know, there were moments of some really, really great service runs that I thought kind of defined the match and helped them win the sets that they won. And but what an excellent way to start off the semis and some really, really great volleyball.
Yeah. Let's go over to Dan.
Yeah, I think Theo said they hit 500 in games two, three, and five, right?
Mm-hmm.
They had to hit 500 to win. That's how they won the match. You imagine you have to hit 500 to win a match. I'm just like, oh, that's ridiculous. You know what I mean? So it's like, hey, if you don't hit five, you're not winning, by the way. So anyway, I thought Theo hit on a lot of great things. It's interesting, like in the serving errors, 27 to 24, just the level of serves and the pace they're bringing. They're like, and the teams are still hitting 500 when they do pass the ball. Do you know what I mean? And so it's like, I think that's pretty ridiculous in terms of that. But It's interesting, like the opposite piece, like you look at the semis and the finals and which opposites are performing well. We all know this as coaches. I think it's the most difficult position to recruit right now. We don't all have Theo's guy that jumps out of the gym. Do you know what I mean? But I think one of the harder positions and one of the weaker positions from a depth standpoint across the country, some of your best opposites are foreign guys in the past 3 or 4 years. And so you look at that position and its performance over these matches a little bit and like, and what was going on there. And ultimately, Ito was a little bit better and was a great server, but it wasn't a position that was dominating. It was a very much middle front pin heavy, both semifinal and final to a point from that standpoint. So, great match.
Yep. We'll go over. Let's go, Jay, and finish up with Brad.
They touched on a lot of points. You know, Irvine got out quick out of the gates in set one. And, you know, I think Niffin was still tooling around with lineups at some point. He put Flexion on the right side there in that first game, and Tangator was doing a real nice job. I know they brought him in for servicey purposes. And when he went down, you could see a little bit of a collective sigh starting to happen. And, you know, Irvine never quit. They never stopped. They kept fighting. They just seem to be one of those teams that it seems like when the chips are stacked up against them, they seem to play better and find ways to win. They're real creative. Everybody knows it's going to Hanno. It wasn't like, you know, how are we going to flip this around and get more to Hanno? You're already going to give him a ton. I think the Canadian kid, you could see there were some moments, especially in the second set or third set when he was in there. He had some other players talking to him, kind of trying to calm him down a little bit and just reassure him like, hey, you've done this before. You know how to play the game. But I think the moment got a little bit big, and I think Irvine gave it every last chance they got. And it was it was still close in the fifth. Wasn't it 9-all or 10-all in the fifth or 11-all?
Yeah. They were battling up until that very last third of the set.
You still had a chance to take it. And I wonder if Tangator was in there, would it be a different story? I don't know. But I do know that they felt a little bit more comfortable with him in there, but hey, next man up. So, you know, kudos to UC Irvine. They had a good year. You know, we talked about Hilaire Hanno being the player of the year. Without Hilaire, I'm not sure Irvine goes that far. But hats off to Niff and the job that he and his staff have done this year and that program. They're very highly respected and well-known, and they're going to go far in the years to come.
All that in a year where he just had a baby midseason.
Yeah. Good planning there, Niff.
All right, Brad.
To me, it was all about Irvine and their adjustments and their ability to adapt constantly in this match that made this match so entertaining and so great to watch. And as someone, I drove up from San Diego to watch both semifinals and Long Beach put on a great event. And it was a full arena and a ton of volleyball people, and getting to be there with Roy Prager, Donan Cruz, John Hawks, and lots of other coaches who were bouncing around. It was a great time, but I thought overall Irvine's ability to adjust, whether it was starting with Flexin on the right, then after Tangator goes down, you know, we're thinking like, ooh, do they move Flexin to the left for set two and try to keep the momentum going? They continued with their lineup, which obviously just won you a set, so not a terrible call by any stretch of the imagination. And then after they're losing some sets, then they look to make those adjustments. They find ways to get Darcy in. Irvine continued to adjust when really the matchup in the middle was really tough for Irvine to stop. McHenry, especially, he was unstoppable really for most of the first three sets. And then Irvine gets real creative and throws Darcy Tague in the middle, Nolan Flexen in the middle to block, and they switch Grigoriev out to the right and do some different things to try to slow down that UCLA offense that, as you guys talked about, was hitting over 500. And Irvine got really aggressive from the service line as well. They brought a lot of heat. They got aces or overpass on 20% of their serves, which is pretty unheard of. But then also Irvine aired at 27%, which is pretty unheard of for Irvine, where they're usually airing at about 15% throughout the year. So really interesting just seeing the different dynamics unfold in the big moments and the pressure. And I thought ultimately it came down to what you guys talked about early on. Ethan Champlin was the best player on the court, and that ended up being the difference, whether it was his serve receive, or him just making good volleyball plays throughout the match. That really gave UCLA the nod there. And then Merrick McHenry's offense consistently throughout the match created a lot of stress and pressure on that Irvine block defense.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought we were gonna make it through without anyone mentioning the play of Merrick McHenry, because he was in the zone that night, mid to latter part of that match. There was one ball he was set. I'm going, all three blockers are up, or two blockers are up. Andon Kiriokou was playing defense in area four, about 2 feet off the net, and somehow McHenry turned his hand, hammered it off of Kiriokou right below his feet. I'm like, how high do you have to jump to hit a ball at that angle by or over the block? So I went up to him after the match and said, Merrick, dude, you must have jetpacks on your ankles, because that shot was insane. Because I was sitting courtside right behind the R2. I'm like, how did he get that ball by? And it had to be because he's just playing in the zone. But definitely one of the key components of UCLA's victory that night was Merrick McHenry. Not only offensively, he had, I believe, 6 block assists, but they couldn't have come at like better times for UCLA. So hats off to the performance on both teams. Exciting. I was a little heartbroken after that one. I mean, I was heartbroken after Akil went down, because when Flexen went down late in the season against Hawaii on night 2, Irvine was winning in that first set, was able to grab that first set and lost the next 3. Because you could tell with the injury, the whole vibe of the team had totally shifted. And I thought we were going to see that again that night, but they ended up really stepping up to the occasion. So Cole Power, libero for Irvine, had a great performance that night as well. Max Grigoriev only had 1 hitting error and was, you know, off of 13 or 12 kills off the top of my head. But I mean, there's some great performances. Like Irvine rose up in the end. UCLA was just, they really delivered right when it counted. So a fun match to watch. I will add, though, on the non-playing side of things, of course, that night could have been marred. The pro-Hamas protests found their way to the pyramid. And as soon as the last ball dropped, I was told to go out on the court and tell everyone to exit out a particular set of doors, because the doors are blocked by protesters. So,
on that note, I was right by those doors, and the security staff, I don't know what company Long Beach used to hire in, but they did a great job managing the safety of the people inside, the people waiting to come in. Just really impressive response by everyone there involved with security in the Long Beach Police Department, to where, as someone who was, you know, relatively close to the everything going on, they kept calm demeanors. They're really poised, helped direct people out after the match. And even I noticed how they got UC Irvine out was different than you traditionally would leave following a match at the pyramid. So I thought the staff there did a great job.
Yeah. I need to correct myself. Pro-Palestine, not pro-Hamas. I don't want anyone to complain. There's just a lot of news going on. The real world's happening outside of volleyball. So just so we're clear, and I'm not meaning to offend anyone, just I was given a last minute script to read and I was like, no way. So, but the good thing is a lot of people stayed to watch the next match, which is what we're going to talk about. Long Beach State, Grand Canyon. Personally, I was looking forward to the Irvine UCLA, but this is the one that was my highlight of the evening. But I'll start with we'll go with Brad first, since I've been leaving you to the tail end there.
Yeah, I mean, this was going to be an interesting match to watch. I think we all knew it. And it was like really a tale of a few different styles. You had very much a Grand Canyon, very much in system offense, really fast speed to the pins, really dynamic offense. And then you had Long Beach State, which was much more simple, much more based on the consistency of volleyball and the consistency of the block and their physicality. You know, and you see it the most, you know, when looking at like Cameron Thorne as opposed to Simon Torwee. And there were some really good matchups. And I think from my end, it was really impressive to see, one, how effective Grand Canyon was those first 2 sets. They were humming and they weren't going to be stopped. And if Long Beach scored 1 point, there was a side out followed right after. And it was tough for Long Beach to really build runs of points, which is something they normally do to have some success. So Grand Canyon's offensive consistency was really, really impressive and just kept fighting off and fighting off Long Beach's serving, blocking, and defense. Then the third set comes around, and the switch from Clark Godbold to Nate Harlan coming in and really creating quite the fun matchup to watch live in the arena between Harlan and Hickman, both guys who play with a lot of swagger, play with the chip on their shoulder. And it showed throughout stretches of that third set there. So yeah, that was really impressive. But I think ultimately, Long Beach started doing a little bit better job out of system those last three sets, killing the ball out of system, finding some edges, getting the ball to the floor around Grand Canyon's really strong defense. That really kind of started to put some pressure on the Grand Canyon offense and serve receive. And Grand Canyon, like Jackson Hickman, was passing a ton of the court. He was taking balls in front of Gianni. He was taking balls in front of the libero. He was taking a ton of responsibility in serve receive, which was pretty impressive to see. And Camden Gianni making his case to be in the USA gym as an outside hitter with how he's performing and his ability to really figure out how to pass so quickly throughout the season. It was an impressive showing there. But ultimately, Long Beach and the crowd really rallying around Long Beach and pushing Long Beach, I thought really gave them the edge when they were on the cusp of the reverse sweep in the fifth set.
Yep. Let's go over to Jay.
Well, I'm gonna talk a little bit on a different perspective of what I was watching. So, you know, Grand Canyon came out in those first two sets and handled it pretty well, and they're up 2-0 all of a sudden. And, you know, I made the prediction that I thought Grand Canyon could win this match, could be the upset, so to speak, even though it's not really an upset, but in Long Beach's gym and they're hosting, it is considered one. I thought the difference maker was in the third set. And this is only because of what I saw. I wasn't there. I don't know if there was maybe some other stuff going on, but it seemed to me that Hickman was getting a little bit more chirpy than normal. And you know, coaches have a phrase, it's, you know, let the sleeping dogs lie. Long Beach was already, you know, in a position that wasn't very favorable, and Hickman had a couple of choice words and some little nods and nudges and winks and whatever you want to do. And, you know, the referee stepped in a little bit, but then Harlan also has a little bit of moxie of his own. And next thing you know, now it's a dogfight. You know, it's a backyard brawl. And Long Beach likes to chirp a little too, as we've seen in some previous matches this year, none more so notably than the Santa Barbara match, where things got a little bit crazy at the end of the match. But you have two teams that seem to thrive off a little bit of this through the net. And I think Long Beach woke up, and I think the crowd should be commended. I'm giving a lot of kudos to the Long Beach crowd. They were pretty quiet at the end of the second set and starting of the third. And all of a sudden, when things started to get up a little bit for Long Beach, I think they were down 11-8 or something like that, or 14-11, I don't know what the score was. But next thing you know, it's tied, and the Long Beach's crowd stepped up and started to push them along. And that was, to me, the difference maker. I thought Grand Canyon looked like they maybe ran out of gas a little bit as the match went on. I don't know if they were tired, but it doesn't look like they were tired. Just ran out of steam. They just couldn't find a way to get a ball. But, you know, kudos to Worley, kudos to his team, but even more kudos to Long Beach to get a reverse sweep in a situation that looked pretty dire.
That place got loud after the second set, and you could see this is where the leadership of Long Beach State came in. Mason Briggs pumping up the crowd, getting them all into it. I mean, talk about a turnaround, reverse sweep with a phenomenal team who's had a phenomenal season. So,
well, it's kind of hard not to fire up the crowd when 78% of them are student athletes on the Long Beach State men's volleyball team. So, you know, when you have that many people, you know, you can all kind of rally around each other. I keyed Long Beach. I keyed because I love you.
I think, Brad, you have to step out. We wanted to let people know you weren't leaving the show permanently. You just were going, you know, to another responsibility.
Yeah, just floating around. But congrats to UCLA, and Long Beach did a great job putting on a great event. And I think my theme for the year, especially looking at those last two teams that were standing, was depth and the ability to make changes in matches became really important. We saw a lot of guys play different roles and step into different spots, whether it be Rama or Alex Knight and Matt Aziz and or Stepanis, Harlan, Godbold. There's a lot of versatility within men's volleyball this year. So congrats to UCLA, and I'll see you guys.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's go to Dan. Thoughts on that semi?
I actually agree with Jay. I think the momentum shift. I mean, we all have players that are a little chippy, and I think Hickman's great, and I think Harlan's great. But I do think you have to know when to kind of dial it in and when to push. When does your group need it? And when does your group not need it? Because you're in a good spot. And I certainly think that was a little bit of a switch, and he couldn't kind of reel it back in when he needed to, unfortunately. And so you saw some momentum shift. I thought the other momentum shift was, you know, they needed Jarrett to serve a few balls in. It's seven missed serves, and five or six of them came as this match. And when they're back and forth a little bit, and you know, he's got a good arm, and he's got some good pace, and he missed a few in the net. You know, it's like, hey, let's put that good pace in range and make Long Beach continue to play. And that was an unfortunate. And they both, I actually think Long Beach missed more serves, but I just thought those were happening at some key moments. He was hitting well, and so that could be another thing that kind of opened the door a couple times for Long Beach. And the other piece for me, and we talked about this, was I thought Long Beach's net play on tips and trash was better than Grand Canyon's. And usually Grand Canyon is so scrappy at defense, and a couple just fell or weren't handled the same way that we'd seen them handle them in the past. Long Beach capitalized on them. And then it's probably the best I've seen Saponis play. Like, you know, ultimately he had a couple broken play swings that were just unreal. He had one that was a 4-4 swing that was off the net a little bit. He had one that was off a dig into a second ball swing. And so just some pretty impressive plays that really carried some momentum for them with the energy from the crowd and all that stuff, which was pretty important.
Yeah. Theo, close it out with you.
Yeah, just so you know, Saponis did that in the Big West tournament. He had those moments already. And wish he would have had a few less, to be honest with you. But no, I think these guys hit it on the head. And I think this match was definitely a tale of adjustments. And you want to talk, I mean, obviously, to get a reverse sweep, there's a massive amount of adjustments that go into it. And I thought that Long Beach did a fantastic job of making some adjustments with their serve and specifically their serve location. They got the ball off of Hickman a little bit more and got it more towards Gianni and put them in a lot of really out of system positions. And if you look at that set one and two, Grand Canyon was in system a ton. And when that team is in system, I mean, they might be the best in the nation. You know, UCLA knows that, Long Beach knows that. And when those guys are grooving, I mean, they're really, really playing great. And if you can't get them off the net, they're going to beat most teams and beat them handily. And I think Long Beach made some adjustments in sets 3, 4, and 5 that got them off the net quite a bit. And, you know, back to Dan's point, you know, one of the unfortunate things about men's volleyball is that we're so limited in the sub department. You know, you only get 6 subs and more specifically, you only get 2 in a spot. And so to have a guy like Anderson who really was playing great, attacking the ball really well, but missing at a 43% error. I know Matt Worley would have loved to have had a guy get in there and at least serve for him and relieve him in that department, but allow him to continue to be as effective as he was offensively. But I thought this was an awesome match and really, you know, this semifinal round was the best part of the tournament in a lot of ways. And so both of these matches going 5 and you know, it really coming down to the wire was really thrilling, super exciting to watch.
Yeah, it was good stuff. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of people didn't get to see after the match were the, if you can go online and find it, I believe it's on there on Long Beach State site, but the post-conference presser with Grand Canyon, but head coach Matt Worley did bring up an interesting point. He goes, you know, tonight was a great night of volleyball. It's unfortunate that it didn't make a major platform. This is what people need to see. And he couldn't have been more spot on. That was the highlight of men's collegiate volleyball. And, you know, he was still thankful for the opportunity that it was broadcast, but just imagine if a crowd would have seen the play that they saw on Thursday night. The other bit was just seeing the gratitude of both Camden Gianni and Nicholas Slight. I mean, they could have these big heads, but they were so thankful for the opportunity. And obviously Camden Gianni has a great story from, you know, basically being resuscitated from being dead and then becoming a we joked about it, six-time player of the year or six-time freshman of the year and all that. But he knows. He's like, even after the conference, he's like, they'll call me grandpa on the team because I'm like 28 years old. So, they just brought up a lot of points. A lot of the nation missed some of the greatest volleyball on Thursday night. So, but it was a great evening for men's volleyball, a great pair of matchups, which then brings us to our finals. UCLA, the number one seed, which there was a lot of discussion about, even in our show about, versus number two seed Long Beach State. Couldn't have happened more better than that. So let's start with
go back to this topic for a second.
Oh, okay.
Why we have this podcast. So like, here's a couple of things. So like, I do think we're headed in the right direction. Like there's been a lot of great volleyball in the past 10, 15 years that hasn't made any platform that it should be making in terms of that. And so, it's great that Worley took a few seconds to kind of say that again. And it was, I think Alan Knipes said it the year before or something like that, in terms of this, we're not putting our sport where it needs to be, but I do think it's headed in a better direction, whether to piggyback off the women's success or any of that stuff, but it's still not at the level. And I think we still have to be making some of that noise, whether it's the NCAA not running a social media platform, whether we're not on ESPN from a coverage standpoint or any of those things. I think we keep making some noise and keep moving the needle a little bit. I think we've got a great advocate in Jamie Gordon from the AVCA, who's in charge of that, who's continuing to work the back doors for us a little bit. You're going to see championships move next year. Monday will be the finals. I think it's Monday, which I think is going to be on ESPN. And I think the push is hopefully to get the semifinals on a platform as well at the same time. And so like, it doesn't negate that we haven't been taken care of, but we all know we can't go backwards, but I still think we keep making some noise. So that's why I think the topic deserves a couple minutes more of us talking about it a little bit in terms of that.
Yeah, please do. So that's for certain things. I know that there was
championships are moved for certain, and it is on the finals is in on ESPN for certain. And I'm pretty sure it's that Monday following that next week. Now that there's 9 teams in for sure. I do not know the 12 yet. It's not going to, that conversation is not happening until June or July, but there was an emergency meeting a couple weeks ago about championships being moved. I think I might've told Theo, I can't remember if I told you yet. Do you know what I mean? But like, I know it's moved. The championship is a week later. Columbus is hosting that. We just don't know the field and the breakdown yet, if it's 9 teams over the week or if, hey, are we going to get to the 12 or the whatever else we can get to in terms of that from that standpoint.
Yeah, and the NEC does get their automatic qualifier next
year. That's why I know the 9s for sure. I just don't know if there's any expansion beyond that. So
yeah, and I agree with you, Dan. We need some strong voices to be able to stand up and speak a little bit louder than we have been. And I had a conversation the other day with somebody about this exact topic, and my response has been, we need to start demanding things like the women's coaches did back in the day. The unfortunate thing is we don't have a Title IX behind us to be able to point and say, this is why. And when we get something like that, where we can use it as an argument to say, well, if you're going to give them this, then you need to give us the exact same thing on this side. And granted, we don't have 300 and some odd teams to be able to expand the field to the size and level, but there has to be a little bit better representation for us, because we're starting to see the momentum really start to move on the women's side. Obviously, they had a great year. You know, obviously you have women's basketball with Caitlin Clark, and there's all this momentum with women's sports. We need to start taking advantage of the fact that we are a sport worth watching. And we need some loud voices to get in there. And I agree. I think Jamie, hopefully, will continue the momentum that he's been kind of working for us. I'm hearing also some rumblings of behind the scenes stuff. But yeah, I mean, we need to strike while the iron is hot for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. The expansion of the tournament has been great, right? We're at 8, which is better than being at 4. And you know, to take you guys back a little bit, in 2010, I had the honor of competing in a Final Four. And I can tell you right now, both the semis and the finals were both televised. That was almost 15 years ago. And here we are. We now are at 8, which is fantastic. But we can't even get the semis televised. And we're talking about the growth of this game, the level that it's at. compared to where it was back when it was getting televised, it is as great as it's ever been. And it's really disappointing to see us grow in certain areas and then take a step back in others. And I echo it. I mean, you can hear it in our voices how important this stuff is to us. But the growth of men's volleyball, and really what's really important to me, is the platform for these young men who already, if you guys don't know, are competing with 4.5 scholarships divided amongst an entire roster. Most of them are paying their way to be a part of this. And the game is incredible. And you got a lot of really, really great volleyball players, a lot of really great student athletes who have something special and need a platform to show the world how great this game truly is.
Good call. Well,
now you can go to the finals.
All right. Well, I'm going to say this because we are going to go long. Are you guys cool with it? Because we haven't even touched on the finals, and technically we're
it's
so
the off season, kind of... Rob. It's the off season.
Yeah, you're just cutting time into my golf game, but that's okay.
I
can wait.
I got about 15, but I think we can get through a couple things. So
okay, finals: the number one seed UCLA versus number two Long Beach State. Thoughts, guys. So let's start. Did I start with Theo already? Did I try to go with Theo?
Because Theo's first now. Go Theo.
All right,
I'll take it. I actually had the pleasure of being at this match and got to watch it in person. The atmosphere was fantastic, as these guys have echoed. And I got to shout out Rob, because I feel like Rob was the man of the night, man. If you weren't at this match, you would have not noticed on TV that this dude was owning the whole house. I mean, he was literally all over the court, microphone in hand, and emceeing the event as if it was like a wedding or something. I mean, it was absolutely fantastic. So Rob, kudos, man. You did a fantastic job. And did
thank
our
you did it our was sport. Loud in there. That's why I lost my voice.
Oh, it was loud, and you know, I think the energy was kept up in between all of the downtime too, which was really, really awesome. I mean, great place to watch the game. So but anyways, two really great teams, and you could tell that we were at the end of the year, right? The Long Beach, you know, both these teams have two very different styles. I feel like from a setter perspective, Long Beach has always relied on just being better than you. Aiden Knipe is not the most fancy setter. He actually runs a really, really sound offense, but most of it is, I'm going to set the best option, and he's going to be a great player, and he's going to outwork you and outlast you. And I think most of the year that was spot on, and it worked, not against UCLA. And, you know, we talked about this guy, Ethan Champlin. We've talked about him a dozen times, but wow, did he shine. And in a night where both Ethan Champlin, Merrick McKendry, you know, obviously Andrew Rowan, I thought set a fantastic night. Merrick McKendry hit 800. I mean, he was so unstoppable. It was absolutely ridiculous. It was like watching a man play with a bunch of children. Champlin hit 289 on 38 swings. I thought Ido David would have been a little bit better. And I think if you look to last year's finals, he was the MVP. I mean, he really carried that team, and I felt like he struggled through times, but still kept his head on his shoulders and was really, really positive out there. And then I thought Cooper Robinson was fantastic. He hit 440 on 25 swings. And, you know, at the end of the day, I felt the reason that Long Beach didn't match up well enough was it came down to Siaponis, and a guy who Long Beach has relied on all year and is the right guy to rely on. I mean, he is a fantastic player and is capable of doing some great things. He really struggled in sets one and two. In set three, they pulled him out. I saw a little bit of a conversation between him and Knipe, and Knipe was kind of like, hey, trust me, let's get some momentum going again, and I'll get you back in there, because they know that he's a big part of that team. He's the heart and soul of them, passion-wise. They found some rhythm with Clark Godbold and Harlan in there, and found a way to put together a few service runs. And At the end, we were looking at a deuce game in extra innings, and Allen put Siaponis back in. They were able to clutch in the win in set three, and then I thought Siaponis was great in the fourth set, but it was just a little bit too late. You know, I thought UCLA passed a little bit better. I thought their service pressure was a little bit stronger. You know, I think they had a few more aces than Long Beach did. But those minor things, especially when you have a couple of teams that are really similar, they made the difference. And I thought UCLA was as good as they've been. And that speech that Sparrow gave at the end of the match, talking about sewer rats, I think is one that will echo for quite some time. And obviously that team went through some challenges and they found a way to be resilient. And, you know, congratulations to UCLA, a well-fought national championship.
I just want to say, to get the context for the sewer rat reference, visit volleyballmag.com. Lee did a really good write-up on what it was, and it's because he's a immunology, molecular biology major in college. I'm referring to Sparov. So get that there. It's a great explanation. Definitely must read. So let's go over to Jay.
I thought he was talking about the sewer rats and the 405 freeway that he had to deal with. So, you know, For me, there is a few different things that I saw. First and foremost, Dan touched upon it earlier, the opposite situation in the country. You had two opposites that last year and throughout the course of this year were incredibly good. And Ido David hit 087 and Varga hit 034 for the match. That's not so good. Now, granted, there were some blocks and there were, you know, there were some unforced errors, but those are numbers that if you really, you know, if you really think that your team is going to be successful at the end of the day, you expect a higher number than that. I saw Siaponis and Godbold obviously, you know, doing some things. I know Siaponis struggled a little bit. He hit 161 for the match, which is not so good for a leading candidate in that program and in the country. And then they brought in Harlan, who I thought was going to be a difference maker for them. And they took him out fairly quickly, which I was a little bit surprised by. But when you look at it, it's because UCLA was serving so well, they needed Siaponis in there. He's a better passer, I think. And I think that's why they kept him in there. But you look at McHenry hitting 800. You look at Champlin hitting 289. You look at Robinson hitting 417. That's a stupid group to be working with in high numbers. I also thought the setting was suspect's not the right word, but questionable at times from Knipe. Torby kind of went away later on as the match developed, and I was surprised that they weren't going to him more. And I know that McHenry's having a good blocking night, so maybe they felt like that matchup wasn't quite in their favor. But if some of your other big guys are not getting it done, you're going to have to find a way to get that guy a few more kills to take some pressure off them, because it just wasn't going in their favor. I got to give kudos to UCLA and Sprah and the crew. They did a great job this year. And, you know, Brad talked about earlier, the two teams in the final were the teams that were the deepest benches, one from a size perspective and one from a caliber perspective. And those are the two teams at the end of the year that I think arguably there's a lot of people on the country that wish they had half that depth. So, you know, but a good final nonetheless. And, you know, now we're able to breathe a little bit and wait for the next year to get going.
Yeah. Well, just on a side note there about Siaponis and his hitting efficiency, you know, he still was getting some really good swings. But what I noticed on UCLA side, this was me trying to pay attention to the details. And I definitely want to text Sparrow because I want to learn. The volley dork in me wants to figure out why this is happening. There are times when Aziz is going left back to his normal defensive position, and certain times he's going right back. Because I rewatched it again last night. I was watching their defensive layout behind the block. I'm like, oh, Aziz is right back. Wait, he's going left back. Wait, he's shifting over to right back. So
it might have to do with whether or not they were scheme blocking and putting two in front of certain people, and therefore they knew they would take they would have a little bit more of the angle taken away and opening up the line a little bit, so they'd shift over there. Or if they're near, they were committing a little bit more at the middle of the right side, and they knew they're going to be one-on-one, which gets to leave on the left side to step in and take a few. That's my understanding of probably why they would do something like that.
Well, Aziz definitely stepped in and took some bombs. He finished the night with nine digs, and I know they're hard hit balls from Schipani, so there's no termination on Schipani's part. But man, UCLA in transition, they got a few extra whacks at the ball because of Aziz getting those balls up.
So yeah, people don't understand how hard it is to hit one of those things. I mean, some of the out of system swings we saw from all the pin hitters. That's really next level stuff. Like there was a couple where I'm looking at going, that ball's coming from behind him over his head and he's still getting wood on it. And you're like, geez, Louise, it's unreal.
All right, Dan takes on the championship match.
Yeah. Again, you go look at the All-American list, and the All-American list is front pin heavy all the way through from first team to second team to honorable mention. So it just kind of tells you, and ultimately this match was a front pin middle dominant match. You do have a couple of the best middles in the country going at it. I think I agree with Jay. I think if Long Beach could have got their middles a few more balls, but ultimately it was a little bit of passing too, and it was tough at times. You know, both their middles hit above 500 with no errors, if I'm correct. I mean, Simon was 8 for 14 and McRaven was 4 for 8. And so I certainly think they wanted to get some more reps there in terms of that. But kudos to UCLA kind of, you know, pummeling and keeping them off a little bit and putting some serving pressure on them, which made it tough at times. And so, here's another thing. Full week of volleyball, third match in 5 days or whatever it is. And I don't care what you're doing. And notoriously, and Theo just talked about this, like you had UCLA hitting 500 against Irvine. Irvine's no slouch on defense. Both these teams hit under 300 on their third match in 5 days. Like, it's just at some point, the gas in the tank isn't the same as it started. You know what I mean? So if we can get this tournament where it's a semifinal and a final, and then your quarters or whatever they are the weekend before, I think that level of volleyball and those legs become even a little bit better. And that doesn't say everybody was playing some fantastic volleyball and giving everything they had. But again, that product becomes even a little bit better at the end because everybody's even a little bit more fresh. And hopefully we're headed that direction. But yeah, just we talk about Merrick and how good he was. Like he was a guy that you might have been able to. There's a reason he was the MPSF Player of the Year. Like, yeah. And I know he wasn't National Player of the Year, but man, you could have thrown him in that category too. Like, just some pretty impressive stats throughout this tournament and hitting percentages and blocking and everything that he was doing for his group. And certainly he's got a bright future as well. But yeah, lots of compliments. Sproul's photo of the semifinal match might be the most emotional photo I've ever seen him in any scenario, just so you guys know. I don't know if you guys saw that. It popped up on some Instagram feeds, it's pretty cool. So when a coach has that much passion for a win, and that wasn't the finals, that was the semifinals. And you see Merrick behind him jumping up and all the guys fired up. Those are pretty cool photos.
Well, in the background on that, Dan, right? Like John leaves Irvine to go to UCLA. What an irony if he doesn't beat his old team, right?
Somebody who coached for him, you know, played for him.
His protege is coaching against him. I mean, he needed that one.
It's perfect for Star Wars Day. Yeah. Jedi Master versus Padawan.
But if you haven't seen that photo, you got to go find it. It's a pretty cool photo, but lots of compliments to both programs. You know, they set the bar really high for all of this, whether it's their depth or how they play or what they're doing. And that's what all of us are chasing. And, you know, I even know, you know, Alan and John are rivals. They get after it. You know what I mean? And there's no mixed emotions on that. One of best two in the business, not only in our country, but in the world. And so to see those teams go toe-to-toe was pretty cool.
Yeah, Kevin Barnett and Paul Sunderland put up a graphic of their similarities between Knipe and Sparra. I was like, wow, I had no idea that a lot of common ground or in areas, they're basically in competition with each other.
Well, and here's another fun factor, a story to think about. In the Final Four, and actually we'll go a little bit different, but you look at the middle blocker position, we've seen a shift starting to happen here. And, you know, and recently as 10 years ago or so, the average middle blocker was 6'8", 6'9". You know, Ohio State's got a kid in the 6'10 range. Long Beach has a kid. Huh? Yeah, seven foot. You know? Yeah, Northridge back in the day. When we played you in 2010 in the national semifinal, if I remember correctly, somebody won 3-0, but I won't get into that. We'll leave that go. But they had a 7-footer in the middle. look at the starting middle blockers for some of these teams, 6'5" and under. I mean, Guinness is what, 6'3" on a good day with some shoes. You know, Wardlaw is 6'5". The middle, what other middle blocker for Long Beach, 6'5". You look at Merrick McHenry, 6'5". These kids are making a difference.
6'7", but five. Six, five.
He's more like 6'8".
No, Merrick McHenry's not 6'8". No, get out of here.
Maybe on a good hair day, like Fletch.
Maybe 6'6". He just jumps so well, it makes it look, you know, the hang time string, it strings it out, the lengthens out the look a little bit, so to speak. But regardless, smaller middles making a difference and could open up the game a little bit, because I know, you know, some of us have smaller middle blockers because we can't go find the 6'9" kids or whatever. And we talk to our young guys and go, hey, you can be effective. You can be good, but you got to be really good at certain aspects of the game. And these guys have opened the doors a little bit. So I give kudos to those smaller middles for what they can do.
They've gotten smaller, Jay, but they've gotten more athletic.
Yeah. Right?
Their ability to move laterally is tremendous. And obviously the jumping abilities. Merrick McKendry might be the best middle we've seen since Max Holt in the collegiate reign. And it's going to be really fun to watch his career, because that guy's headed for some big time things.
Well, and the middle that he was a blueprint of was Kofi, who was right behind him or right before him, that also touched 15 feet. So
yep.
There's some history there. Some middle blockers being real effective.
Yeah, that's I forgot his real name. Just call him Kofi Kid, as is a rap or a musical artist name. But he's back on Team Canada now. So,
he's a pro too.
That's right. Yeah. So an exciting finals. I'll just add the post match if we are done talking about the play. Man, talk about Ethan Champlin. We've talked about him pretty much, I'd say, every other podcast minimum because of the stuff he's doing, but watching him at the last ball drop, 2 minutes in, he gets his cap and his t-shirt, just lays out flat on his back, like to a point where I think he drew medical attention or the medical staff. And, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, what happened? He was so exhausted from his emotions and playing. And realizing, I finally found out in the press conference afterwards, a reason why he just laid out. He's like, I was overwhelmed with emotions. And it wasn't because they just won. It's because it's the last time he's going to be playing with these guys. And I was like, oh, that was one of those, what, did the dust start blowing in here? And you could see, I got a picture of his eyes are still pink red from crying. But it was just was so cool to see that this guy gave everything that he had for this match. He even said, had that gone a fifth set, he didn't know if he's going to be able to go. So he ended up getting a most outstanding player and a great touching moment. You know, obviously, you know, Long Beach State gave it all they had and their crowd started getting into it. But in the end, I think the heart of Champlin was the pulse that got them over the top in that fourth set. So, you know, yeah, the play was there, but man, that saving dig for match point, Champlin's not there in area one and just throwing his arm, lunging out and throwing his body out, and it goes over. I don't know if he could have gone a fifth set easily. Had Varga just turned that block in, because David was there on defense, but who knows what kind of ball would have come off of his dig, because he was coming so fast for the net and he just wisely let it fall out of play. So a game of inches. Any final thoughts on that final match of the evening to determine our champion? All good. Excellent stuff. We are definitely 15 minutes over, and there was some big news that happened this week too. So I'm kind of stuck at where to go. Thumbs up from Theo. Dan?
Let's do it.
I'm probably bouncing out, but you're going to talk about the transfer portal, I think. Throw my 2 cents in. I think there was about 50 to 100 guys in there before conference tournaments got done. Conference tournaments got done, and the next week you saw another 100 to 150 kids go. Now, these aren't all D1 kids. I mean, you're talking about D3, NAIA, D2. And you're going to see more kids jump in this week. And certainly there's some highlighted guys, you know, the center went to Ohio State, and Tim, who's going to BYU. And so there's some guys in there, and there's other talented guys. And You see a lot of NAI, D3, D2 guys going, hey, can I take the next step into a top 20 team? And then what are some of these? Like, you had the opposite from Turkey that was at Hawaii, who didn't play, who was at Jamestown the year before, who was really, really good. He's going to Mount Olive, which will help Mount Olive. And so, yeah, I think we're not like basketball where there's 3,000 guys on there, but I think there's more movement this year than there was last year. So it'll be interesting, like, when we talk about this, maybe we do another podcast in 2 or 3 weeks about, hey, where does this transfer portal gone and where have some of these guys landed or ended up? Because I think you're going to see some of that movement over the next few weeks. And you're going to see some guys from the Final Four teams with meetings this next week where it's like, which are the second guys behind that are super talented? You got to remember, like, some of these benches at Long Beach and UCLA and some of these other programs, their second and third guys going to start for some other teams. And so where do these some guys, what programs have money left and are in positions to help guys? And what does that look like a little bit? And then if you're paying attention, the NCAA just passed where you can multiple transfer. We don't have a ton of that yet in men's volleyball, but like both Division I and Division II passes, certainly you meet certain academic requirements where it's like, hey, I can go to a third school if I want to. And where does that look for like men's volleyball? But yeah, those are my.
All right. So we're on the portals subject, and I know both Jay and Theo have stuff to say. So let's jump in. Go, Jay.
All right, guys. See ya.
I'll be honest with you. The portal to me is starting to look a lot like the European pro leagues. And what do I mean by that? It's not the number of foreign kids that's in it, but you're seeing what Dan talked about. A lot of guys at the D3, D2 NAI level that maybe got in because that was the best fit for them, but maybe they've made some progress and now they want to take their talents to the next level and they're jumping up as high as they can. So that makes the lower levels somewhat of a farm program, if you will. I think the next thing you're starting to see is players, like you mentioned, that don't want to sit. They don't want to sit behind, you know, another guy, or they know that their coach recruited in this, you know, a top five kid in the country. And now all of a sudden the battle just becomes this, well, now I'm going up against this kid and I'm not going to get a fair shake. Or maybe the coach is telling them, hey, you know, that's not the best position for you, and we're going to go with this guy instead. So now they're kind of left to their own devices. The challenge, I think, with the transfer portal for a lot of us is, you know, years ago, there used to be 25, maybe 30 or so blue chip kids. And those kids all went to the top programs and everybody was fighting for the next 50 kids or so that were pretty good. And you were taking a chance. Now there's 50 kids a year that are really, really good. And then there's another 150 to 200 kids around the country that are really, really good. And they're not necessarily blue chip, but they're not, you know, also rants. They're maybe green. And you kind of look at it and go, man, this kid's got size. He's physical. We could work with that for a year or two and see what he pans out to be. Then you got the transfer portal. You got all the Europeans that want to come over. I mean, we're starting to see where recruiting the young kid, you know, as a sophomore or junior in high school, in the hopes that they pan out. When you know it doesn't work out, well, that's okay. You got a couple of safety nets behind you now, so you're not necessarily stressed about whether you get the top kid or not. Now you can go, hey, if I don't get that kid, I'm getting the portal and find another kid, and he'll be just as good, or maybe he's battle-tested and wants to go somewhere else.
Yeah. Theo.
Yeah, I mean, the portal is such a unique thing, right? And, you know, I think the landscape of NCAA athletics is actively changing. You know, for me, I'm personally in a space where I see both sides of the coin, right? I see the need for something like this to exist and the ability for players to go and find a place where they truly fit. But, you know, I want to go back to the theme that I think Brad talked about as soon as he signed off, and what we have all been talking about is the depth, right? Depth is what wins championships. And the question that I think inevitably is looming over the portal is, how can depth exist if the guy who's next in line doesn't want to sit and compete? And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's more just a fact. I think as human beings, we are constantly given challenges, and challenges and failures are what help us grow. sort of what help us change or what help us identify who we are. And, you know, I go back to John Sparrow's comment about his team's ability to deal with the stuff, to deal with the challenge. They didn't really have a proven libero, and they had to figure out who's going to do this, who's going to get there. And the player's willingness, you know, Ethan Champ was a national championship outside. Alex Knight is a national championship outside. What in what world would you move that guy to libero? Well, when you're going to look for another option and a way for this current team to be successful. And, you know, I think we're different than men's basketball. We're different than football. We're different even than women's volleyball, because with only 4.5 scholarships, everything is about money in a lot of ways. And, you know, for depending on what school you're talking about, if you leave a school like Long Beach State, where tuition is $7,500 a year, and you want to transfer to USC, USC is $100,000 to go to school there. And so if you are on a 50% Long Beach, and let's just say, not knowing if USC has a 50% for you, those are big differences in what you're actually paying out of pocket. I think that one of the beautiful things about our sport has always been the culture. We have some really, really great coaches, some really, really great programs in places where young men have had an opportunity to develop, to grow and learn. The idea of players needing to spend 4 different years at 4 different programs under 4 different coaches with 4 different teammates. I don't know that the long-term gain is quite as valuable as the short-term. And so I think that's an interesting piece about the portal. We could talk about it forever. I think there's some good to it. I think there's some negatives for sure. But it definitely makes things interesting, especially on Twitter.
Yeah. And I'll piggyback on that quickly. I know we got a lot to do here. You mentioned about, you know, these players transferring every year and going different places, Theo. You know, back in the day, and you and I can wax poetic about this, each program had its own personality, right? And, you know, Northridge had its personality, and, you know, UCLA had his, it's USC had his, and Mason had this. It's like everybody kind of fit into a certain different group because that's how they were. Now, when you got players bouncing around, you're changing a lot of that, and you might not get the similar type character that comes into your program, and that could change things in a different direction completely from where the program was historically. I would find it really hard to see Northridge, who I've always seen as a program that plays with a really massive chip on its shoulder, kind of an FU to all the other big time schools that didn't give them the money. I'd hate to see that become a program that is a little bit more aloof and is maybe more like, oh, we're Northridge, and it's a wholly different personality. And I just, it would blow my mind to see that. I don't think it's going that direction, but it just, you look at it and go, could that ever happen? Because maybe you have an immediate need one year of need 5 kids in your program, and you get 5 kids from 5 different places that have 5 different ways of doing things, and they just completely change the personality and temperature of the room. So it'll be interesting to see if that ever happens to anybody.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we've alluded to the Sparrow sewer rat quote. I've got to read it at this point because so people can understand. But just so you know, it actually, the question was posed in the press conference to Sparrow, how would you best describe your team? And it was Ethan Champlin that whispered in Sparrow's ear, sewer rats. And that's why Sparrow went off on it. But here it is from the volleyballmag.com article. Let's see, it says, you're a little bit at risk when you come play at UCLA because your head coach majored in microbiology and genetics. In his favorite class, he was an undergrad, was immunology, and it turns out that the immune system of sewer rats is something to behold. And that little critter runs around in a bunch of muck, and you know what, and it turns out nothing bothers them. They don't have allergies, they can eat all the peanuts they want, they can do whatever they want because their immune system is conditioned to things that really matter. And that's the context of the quote from Coach Sparrow.
And it's so, and obviously he compared it to their ability to deal with any and everything that was thrown at that team and weather the storm and whatever you know, for lack of a better term, but what doesn't kill you only makes you better. And they're the champs. So,
yep. So with our, you know, the transfer portal thing though, with this changes going on, I didn't realize it was that high of a, on the men's side, because, you know, I follow college VB transfer, but it's mainly women and beach players that are in there. There's not really a place, a central place to see all these transfers, is there?
Yeah, yeah. Transfer portal.
Yeah. Well,
that's public access.
No.
See, college volleyball transfers, somehow someone has inside access.
Rob, to your point, it hasn't become big enough that it's been a thing to discuss. And so far, the 4.5 scholarships has been really the major thing that's limited it, I believe. You know, finding a place that makes sense. There's only a couple other places that are like that for a lot of the kids financially, right? And mm-hmm. we're going to see the portal continue to grow. And in addition to when you start to add in the NIL money and having various programs, having collectives and the ability to use that to supplement scholarship, now you might see a little bit more of a shift and some flexibility to continue to add players and make it financially make sense. Where on the women's side, you leave USC or you leave Long Beach, doesn't really matter what you were paying. You're on a full scholarship on both sides of the net. It's irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll get to have to explore that as it continues to grow. I call it portal poaching, but that gives it a negative context. I know some guys go in there after finishing their bachelor's degree and then they want to get a graduate degree somewhere else, which totally respectable. Now it's when they do it behind the back of coaches. That's where I have the problem. You know, you're an adult, talk to the coaches, let your intentions be clear. Don't be pulled a behind the scenes thing, because good people across the program. And I say that I will vouch for anyone on the men's side that just talk to your coaches. They're good people. You know, they'll understand your situation. So there's your life lesson. Sorry to preach, but there was one other piece of news, and the only reason I bring it up is because we've seen a shift now. I mean, obviously in the EIVA, another great conference, but Luke heads on over from Charleston and becomes an associate coach at Pepperdine. One move, I'm not sure if there can be others, but obviously Charleston fills it with Thomas Poole. Is that correct? At the head?
Yeah, he was the assistant coach there for the last couple of years. And, you know, it was a good move for Luke and his wife. They both got jobs at Pepperdine coaching, and that's a pretty good area to be. Obviously, Malibu's not too shabby compared to, you know, middle of David Western Hunt. Virginia. Yeah. I mean, listen, if you have the option of living in Charleston, West Virginia or Malibu, I'm not so sure that's a hard decision to make. But, you know, their assistant coach, Poole, took over the job there, and he's going to continue with, I think, the direction they've been taking it, which is mostly European kids, and they're doing a nice job, and, you know, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, dude, I've had the pleasure of getting to know Luke, and Luke is an incredible coach with an incredible background. And I think what he adds from an international experience perspective to Pepperdine, I think, is huge. And I only see Pepperdine benefiting from this move. And I think it's a good move for Luke at the same time. I think he's been wanting to get out to the West Coast and get his feet wet in terms of, you know, the programs out on this side. And so congratulations to him.
You know, and the only interesting thing will be, you know, Luke is not known for being a coach that sits on the bench during a match. He's a little animated at times, which, listen, myself included, I know what he feels like. It'll be interesting to see if that gets tempered down because he recognizes he's no longer the head coach and he just lets Winder do his thing. Or does Winder have that conversation and all, or does it still continue and Winder's okay with it, not okay with it? Like, that's the only thing I'm really interested to see, because I want to see if Luke's going to, you know, be true to himself. But no, it's a good move for him and his family.
What do you mean, Gandalf of Malibu, a.k.a. Marv Dunphy, he's going to be there with his wizard stick.
Yeah. Well, listen, and they get their new facility built here in the next couple of years. It's now going to cost $180,000 a year to go to Pepperdine. It'll be crazy.
Well, you know, with that, he's hired on as an associate or an assistant, because I do believe Matt Pollock was elevated to the position of associate head coach.
So somebody here earlier on here was talking about how they have like three associate head coaches, which I don't know how that works, but Not my program, not my circus, not my monkeys. I don't care.
Yeah, I think they're both associates, judging by the website, Rob.
Wow. Okay. Well, that was hot off the press. Well, it sounded like we're going to have another episode here. This is supposed to be the closeout episode, but again, I want to respect our fans and taking the time to type out their questions on Volley Talk on Instagram.
We're going
to
answer them. We're going to answer them, yes. Everybody. I promise.
It was just such a great championship week with a lot of news. How could we not talk about all the stuff that happened? I know I missed out on a bunch of little side stories, but hopefully they're showing up on social and on press releases on the team sites, because there's a lot of good stuff that happened. It's an exciting time, and it was truly an honor to be a part of it in person again. I mean, Jay was graceful enough to invite me last year at Fairfax, which is another phenomenal experience, but to get the nod for Long Beach too was totally an honor, and so close to home and see the crowd that we had in two solid years of championships in a row. And only reason I missed the previous year, actually, it was in UCLA. That was a good year too, but 2021 is the only one I missed in the last few years. And we know what happened there. No, well, actually that was pre-COVID or post-COVID. So, but it was a great year of championships, and we only see the men's game growing. And it doesn't happen without you, our fans, listening, and these great coaches who take their time every week, who two dropped off, but I want to give them props for this season, even though we're going to have another episode. Dan Friend of Lewis, Brad Rostrater of UC San Diego, Jay Hossick of George Mason, and Theo Edwards of CSUN. Again, another episode. We'll let the other guys know. If not, you'll at least have Theo and Jay on, because they're the ones that are here left on the show, this extended version. But I appreciate your guys' time and efforts and your insight, because we get such great feedback and comments and even some jabs here and there, which makes it even more fun. Mainly Jay. Everyone likes Theo, but with Jay, he's the poosterer. So we didn't throw that much salt this year. I think we kind of like each other a little bit. So
ran out of salt.
All right, guys, have a great rest of your day. And thank you again for all your stuff. I mean, it's only we can really encapsulate it as stuff this entire season, but we have one more at least, and maybe a special topic on if we talk portal, because it sounds like the can is going to open soon.
Let's open the can of worms. I love it.
Thanks for listening to College Volleyball Weekly. Be sure to follow Rob Aspero at the Rob on the Mic on Instagram and at Rob on the Mic on Twitter.